Captain Bauer, Reel 3. You said the Chinese welcomed you into the line. Was this through a loudspeaker system?
Yes, they had the loudspeaker tannoy system, you know, like the railway station on a football field or something in the old days. And then they'd play music as well. There was always music, and Diana Durbin was one of the popular things. I remember very well one night when I was out on patrol, I got lost. And whilst we were considering, or I was considering how to get back, there was Diana Durbin singing The Lights of Home. I remember that very well indeed. But yes, they had these loudspeaker systems.
Did they make a lot of use of them?
No, not as far as we were concerned. I think they probably did with the Americans, because they were their arch enemy. But there was no political chit-chat as far as we were concerned. There was a Gregory Peck film on the other day. I forgot what it was called now, but this was quite good, really, about Korea. It was an attack on China. I don't know where you saw it. But they were using the loudspeakers in that, and the political bit as well. You know, saying, okay, you know, and then we'll destroy you very shortly and this kind of stuff. But it was very politically oriented broadcast, where ours weren't really. I don't recall anything that was, you know, it was just welcome the Durhamite infantry, and then they play a bit of music. I think perhaps they touched on the, you know, you're the puppets of the imperialist Americans touch, but it, you know, it didn't mean a thing to us, really, and take it seriously.
Did they ever deliver leaflets to you, or Christmas cards, or anything like that?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I've got a Christmas card, haven't I, which you've just seen, and I can't think how I came by it. But I think they did, but I think they scattered them on the valley floor, so if you went on patrol you could pick them up and that kind of thing. Yes, I think that they did a bit of that, but it wasn't done in a grand scale.
Do you think that that sort of pressure or attempt to apply pressure had any effect?
None whatever. None at all. I think the boys were very lucky, pleased to have them and send them home as souvenirs. You know, but it was, we were not material for politicking, you know, no way.
Once the sun came up and it was light and so on, what was the first general impression you got of the section of line you were in?
That's a very nice thought, really, because when the light came up as opposed to the sun coming up, you got this incredible vista, or whatever the word is, of the early morning mist. And I think the word Korea actually does, I believe anyway, the land of the early morning mist, something like that. And whereas you would normally see your valley floor and your enemy position and so on, the whole thing was shrouded in mist up to your eyeball level. So you got this unbelievable view of tiny hills, you know, which was always the left, like icebergs, and it was very romantic indeed. But once the mist had gone, your view was the valley floor, the enemy positions, all very close, remarkably close. It obviously varied from 100 to 200, 300 yards, depending on where you were, but generally speaking, it was 1,000 yards was probably the most. And you know, there was your view. You very, very seldom saw any movement. And if you did, of course, that was a classic excuse to bring down every sort of aggression, divisional firepower and things like that, because we did have enormous artillery support, which I'm sure has never happened before. May have done in Vietnam, I don't know, but you could call on divisional firepower for a very small area. It was remarkable.
You say there were the enemy positions. Could you spot actual individual field works?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think it was you know, sort of dips in the ground, and obviously where they were digging, and you concentrated with your glasses and this kind of thing, and you could see. But there were no sort of. I think we were much more obvious to the enemy than they were to us. We used to put down helicopter landing strips, crossed, you know, red and green or something, for casualty evacuation and that kind of thing. And I'm sure in a lot of cases the Chinese could see those, but because we didn't realize they could, if you see what I mean. But generally speaking, there was nothing to show that they were there, except that you could follow the lines of trenches here and there and that kind of thing. But it was quite difficult, except that you knew they were there.
Well, how could you follow the line of trenches? What could you actually see? Was there sort of spoil on the...
Yes, the lines in the side of the hills where they'd been digging and that kind of thing. But it wasn't all that obvious. It was obvious when, from time to time, the Americans used to bomb them in napalm, and you could see the stuff running down the trenches. And that's when, you know, you probably didn't realize that there was a trench there, that kind of thing. But you could actually see the rough outline of where they dug. But they were very good at it.
Did they have any tunnels in your area?
Personally, I don't know, but I think they did. I think they were very good at tunneling, as they proved to be in Vietnam much later on. But I think that they did tunnel into the hills, whereas we didn't. You know, they tunneled and came out in the event of attack or anything like that, because their modus operandi was different from ours. I think they were more we were there defending and aggressive, and I think they were there just defending in a holding position. Unless they had any particular reason to see anything, then they'd shell it.
What were your own positions like in general terms? Was it a continuous line of entrenchment or a layout of redoubts?
It was, yes, redoubt is a nice word. You had your hutchie where you lived and slept, and you had your fighting pit where you stood to and would have defended from. And both were dug into the earth. One was obviously on the forward slope. Your hutchie, wherever possible, was on the reverse slope, to make it as simple as possible. Your hutchie probably housed two or three people. You dug it deep, and then you put the Royal Engineers produce prefabricated building material in the form of logs, metal pickets, and I leave it to your imagination to how you would dig a hole and build a roof on it, and either use wood or pickets and sandbags, whatever waterproofing equipment or materials you had. Plastic sheeting I don't think had been invented yet, wish it had. Anything that you could find to put on top of that, and then on top of that you put as much earth as you could. And a lot of hutches took direct shots from 60mm mortars, and they were perfectly right. That was where you... And so you made your bedding out of pickets. Metal pickets were in great demand. They were all American, and they used to come up with the quartermaster stores. You'd wire those and make your beds with them and strap waterproof sheeting between, and all sorts of stuff was used for bedding. And sometimes you might have a dry area, so your hutchie was dry and you could clear a dry patch on the earth and this kind of put a sleeping bag on it, that kind of thing. The fighting trenches over the time we were there improved tremendously with tenacity and wish to improve. So that you had a fighting pit where you could, basically, generally speaking, you had a small fighting pit which was perhaps 4-5 feet deep, or probably not quite as deep, depending on the size of your Geordie who was in it, and either end of it you'd have a bunk hole, a funk hole we call them, which was beautifully sandbagged and very secure. Into the side of the fighting pit you would build an ammunition box, and you'd keep your hand grenades in there, probably a certain amount of ammunition, but generally it was your hand grenades, so that in the event of your standing to and you were subjected to a bombardment, you could get your head down and you'd be perfectly right, unless you were very unlucky to get a direct hit. And then as soon as the barrage lifted or whatever it was, you could come up into your fighting pit in a stand to position with your hand grenades, your Bren gun, your rifle, all your stuff. And that's how it worked. So, and in between those, you would have a trench system. Some were deeper than others. Some you covered with camouflage netting, depending on how vulnerable you felt you were. So you can imagine a hill occupied by 30 people in a very strong defensive position trenches between your fighting pits and your sleeping hutches. You had urinals set into the side of the trenches or in areas. It depended on the geography of the area you were in. And we had, it was usually a 60mm mortar case was used as a pissoir, I think. And you had this chlorine powder sent up, and you'd scatter that all the way around the area so that it you know, kept the smell down and also kept it clean. And then at some area dotted around, you'd have a loo, and that was usually, depending on the expertise and the imagination of whoever was in your position, to build a decent loo. And sometimes we had the most comfortable lavatories, depending entirely where you were. And there was always plenty of stuff, building material to use, and imagination, you know, some were uncomfortable, some were quite comfortable. And you dug deep, and you could often sit and view the enemy lines from... but every position had a bog somewhere.
Did you have a specialist loo builder in your
company? Yes, well, the specialists were really the pioneer, well, they called the pioneer platoon, weren't they? And they were probably one sergeant and several corporals and lots of men taken from within the infantry battalion. And they dug and they built and they hacked away and they built bridges and they were bloody good. They didn't actually build your own hutches, but they would do a battalion quarters, for instance. If a bridge needed reinforcing, or they would cut trees down, and that was before whizzy saws as well. And they were terrific. But they were all pitmen, and they were all used to building down in you know, we were fortunate. But they didn't necessarily specialise in building bogs and things, but the battalion quarters is usually pretty well looked after.
These fighting pits you were describing, were they one-man pits, two-man pits?
Two or three. Ideally, depending on the situation, two men was the right thing. For, you know, comradeship, so that someone could probably doze off a bit while the other chap was watching, and that sort of thing. And you would always like two men if someone got wounded, you know, could cry out for help or something like that. Two was the ideal number. It didn't always work out like that, but generally speaking, that's what one worked for. So that you were you shared a hutchie with your mate, and you shared your fighting pit with your mate. And that was how it, you know, the ideal arrangement. Sometimes there were four, but obviously you don't want too many people in one spot. There was one or two instances of extraordinary bad luck. I think one tank had a direct mortar bomb went straight down the hatch, you know, that kind of thing. And two people were caught in a trench together, and so they were both killed, this sort of thing. But obviously, two was the ideal number if you could get aim for that, you know, could achieve that.
You mentioned there were communication trenches between the sleeping area and the fighting area. How deep were they?
Well, this depended on how you were overlooked, how much you were overlooked, or you felt you were overlooked, or you knew you were overlooked. But sometimes they were quite deep. You know, you had plenty of time, so you could dig deep, and you were down 6 feet. So you could move. If you felt you were being seen, you could move from A to B without being seen. And sometimes there was no need to do that deep. But if you dug that deep, then you cover it with a camouflage net and probably covered it in. But it was... it depended very much on where you were, on the geographical situation, because no one hill was ever quite the same. And you struck up Virgin Hill and you say, well, that fucking hell, do we start to dig from here, you know? And so you dug, and then the next chap came and dug a bit more, and the next chap came and dug a bit more, and then someone come along and say, they don't like this, but dig somewhere else, you know? But 4 to 6 feet, I would have said, was roughly the ideal. We didn't always achieve that, but it was good digging in land. It wasn't rocks and stuff, not generally speaking. It was earth. So you had plenty of earth to fill your sandbags. Sandbags were very good quality. They were American, needless to say, and they were very good. So you filled those with earth, and, you know, stuff you dug out, you dug back again.
Did you have to use sangers anywhere?
Use what?
Sangers.
Not sure what a sangar is.
A breastwork of rock or sandbags.
Oh yes, you built those everywhere. You'd be surprised at the prowess of the British infantry soldier in building his pit. And because, not necessarily, but because they were Geordies and they dug well, the pit was extremely well built with, yes, rest for your rifle, building in your... We used to have fighting pit inspections and Hutchie inspections, which other arms didn't have. The Americans didn't, and the French. Some of their positions were quite dreadful, but we used to inspect the fighting pits for cigarette ends and make sure they were clean. And the hand grenades were oiled, you know.
Did they revet the?
Yes, we used it to work with handbags. There was nothing else to use, you see, there was no scrub when we were there, all the trees had been blown aside and that kind of thing. But there was no shortage of sandbags, so you could always be built with sandbags. And that was our revetting, really. But the chaps, they were very... we had these iron pickets, you see, metal pickets, which were about, 3 or 4 inches wide, 6 foot long, and they would interlock. You could interlock them, so you could imagine, and they had holes in them as well. You can imagine how useful they were for just about everything. It was like the, you know, what was that, Dexian slotted angle shelving kind of stuff. It was used for everything. You built your beds, your radio, put your radio on, or your wireless, and it was, you know, they were used a lot in the fighting pits as well.
How were the platoons actually laid out? Were they laid out in line of sections in positions, or
what
did
positions?
You have? Yeah, did you have two platoons up and one back or anything like that?
Not really. No, you would defend, from what I recall. You would build entirely on the geographical situation you were in. The battalion position, you would expect to be two platoons forward, two companies, but it wasn't like that at all. You took a chunk of land, and on your left, if you were a battalion, on your left was the Black Watch, on your right was the 2nd Canadian Rifles, something like that. You knew where they were. They knew where you were. You knew exactly where your chums were on your left. And it was pretty clear where your left and right of arc were. And you would build to defend that position as best you could. And it depended, like so many other things, entirely on the geography of the bit of land that you got stuck with, because none of it was like the next bit. You know, it was all different. It was all up and down. It was all over the place. And you dug as best you could, or to the way you felt was the best defensive idea in that particular section. So there was nothing laid down, except, of course, that you always had your battalion headquarters in rear, and that was probably the only way that one conformed with a standard handbook on defensive position.
Accepting this, the fact that it was all ad hoc, were there distinct platoon and company areas?
Oh yes, like the birds, we had our very defensive areas, you know, and depending on the artistic prowess within the your little unit, or how your company commander felt, that once you arrived, you knew very well that you were 1st Battalion Downright Infantry, because we probably had that already painted in England, you know, and your signs were prolific everywhere. C Company, B Company, A Company, you know, latrines, please keep the area tidy. And of course, that leads on to minefields, which is a totally another subject, but not unrelated, in that the funny thing was that you put your minefield out, but you marked it. And we had a lot of trouble with taking over from other people who hadn't bothered to look after their minefield fences. And I know it is a kind of contradiction in terms. I think it's rather like selling cigarettes and saying that these are dangerous. But you had your access and exit from your company and platoon positions for using very clearly marked. But that was a two-edged sword, because you knew how to get out, you knew how to come in. If the Chinaman chose those, he'd be shot to bits. If he came any other way, he'd be blown up. So it was pretty good logic. But it was essential to sign and mark your minefields. And we had minefield patrols every morning. Someone would go out to check the minefield, which wasn't a very welcome task, because it was usually light. But you'd walk around and they had those triangular signs on. And we had a lot of trouble. We lost one or two people killed because of badly marked minefields. But signing, if that was the question, or indication of where you were, was, you know, was all important. And quite a lot of humour crept in from time to time.
How far back from the front edge was the battalion headquarters?
This comes on to a very interesting and very pertinent side of the war. Because there was no Chinese air, the battalion quarters didn't necessarily have to be very far back, but probably, looking at a map, it might have been a quarter of a mile, sometimes more. There again, it depended so much on the geography of the position that you were holding at that time. And it could be that because of, you know, some hill or another, it was probably further than. But it was always very clearly marked. There was always tracks. You went from your platoon position down to a track to company headquarters to another track, which led you onto a road, which led you straight down to battalion headquarters. But because there was no air, the battalion headquarters, in answer to your question, was probably a quarter of a mile, perhaps half a mile, seldom further. And there, people could live in relative comfort.
Did you have your own platoon command post?
Oh, yes. This is very much one's home. And you sign, you know, A Company, number 3 platoon headquarters, and Browning machine gun headquarters. You know, that's where you slept. I used to try and get a hutchie, so I slept somewhere else. But that's where your depending again on circumstances and the danger and so on, how much space you had. But with a little ingenuity and a few shovels, you could build things. And so you had your platoon headquarters where your signaller was. You sat yourself. Your platoon sergeant would probably sleep there and take over from you, because the thing was manned 24 hours a day. And you probably have a little bunk next door in another hole in the ground, you know, but certainly everybody had their own little headquarters area. You had your wireless there, you see, as well.
Did you have wireless communications forward to your sections?
Yes. I've forgotten the kind of wirelesses we had now, but you had standing patrols, which is another long story, and perhaps we should leave for another time. But in answer to your question, was that the standing patrol, or patrols, depending on how many you had, had wireless communication to someone all the time. And you had wireless communication to company headquarters, and they had wireless communication to battalion headquarters. And often the company headquarters had wireless communication to your Royal Artillery. I don't think we had Royal Artillery more forward than company headquarters, but certainly there was a strong element of artillery at battalion headquarters. You had a major Royal Artillery would be there, and you had Royal Artillery spotters up in your section areas as well. So your gunnery is terrific. We could reserve that for another story. But yes, communications were good. They could have been a great deal better. And I'm sure now, I think we relied a lot on batteries and things in those days, you know. Now it would, you know, you'd have microwave communication of some sort, which I'm sure they had in Vietnam, that kind of thing.
Did you make any use of line communication?
Yeah, yes. We had the Jack, what was it, the Don 5, wasn't it called, something like that? We had those as well. We had, often we had wireless and the line. And sometimes the line was much better, because if your battery went out or something. You know, the radios weren't terrible, the wirelesses were not reliable. I think they were called 31 sets that came in during the time we were there, and they were the most modern thing, but they were not reliable. And the telephone jack was often much better.
What was wrong with the wirelesses? Was it batteries running out? Or was
I don't
it other
know.
Things?
I don't know. But it could have been frequencies or something like that. But we had problems with wirelesses, which should have been much better, because you took a wireless down onto the valley floor with you. You couldn't take a line. Well, you'd take a line out to a standing patrol. But often you'd try and get, you know, and they couldn't fucking well hear you, you know. For some unknown reason. It could have been the geography, frequencies and all this kind of thing, and the fact that the radios just weren't good enough. But they were certainly better than they were when we started. You know, the radios that we used to use, the wirelesses we used to use.
Did you normally speak in clear when you were using the wireless?
You used, yes, but you...